What I want to do this morning is to continue. I was saying on, where are we? We're Tuesday, aren't we? Yeah. I was saying on Friday that there were probably three basic symbolic reference in all human societies. The absolutely fundamental one is the human body, about which I shall lecture on Friday. Some of you think I'm out of sync, but actually I think I'm dead in sync. I usually get the order of these lectures wrong because they're random, but this time I think I've given them as promised. So anyhow, it's bodies on Fridays. The body is one basic reference, then animals, and I think the third one is buildings and houses, and it's buildings and houses that I want to talk to you about this morning. Now, what I want to talk about is the social and cultural aspects of the built environment. Years ago, a kind of proto-anthropologist in the good old days, with anthropology was a sort of gentlemanly occupation for rich men, a Lord Raglan said of the house, the first house was not a hut, but a temple. And what Raglan was doing was arguing against all those architects who think that in the beginning tribal people sort of stuck a banana leaf above their heads and that was the beginning of architecture, and it wasn't until, you know, Gothic architecture, King's College Chapel and all that, that people began to build in symbolism. And this is the sort of Malinowskian view of culture, that it's only with leisure that people have time to get going and start putting on symbolic decoration on things. What Raglan is suggesting is that right from the very word go, housing is symbolic, that housing is imbued with culture. The first house was not a hut, but a temple. It's imbued with meaning and value. In short then, and this is another theme of these lectures, the symbolic and the real, of course buildings serve to keep the rain out, but that's by no means the end of the story. What else do they do? Well, one thing they do, which is something which you probably aren't very aware of, but which is nonetheless true, is that housing or buildings, the built environment, acts as a device for socialization. That all unbeknownst to you, as you rattle around or crawl around in your house as a little baby, you very quickly, and as you're a child, you very quickly take on into your body, in a sense, some very basic cultural categories. So that, for instance, most of you probably live in a house which has got something. It's probably got a front door, and there's probably a front-back axis in which the front is relatively public space and the back is relatively private space. So that, well, you might not, but lots of people do. Go down where I live in Cambridge and you will find that this is the dining room, the visitor's area, and that's the kitchen, and there's usually a loo out the back. There's also, maybe not in your house because you live in a bungalow, but in most people's houses, there is an upstairs-downstairs distinction, so that the upstairs is relatively intimate and the downstairs relatively private. And when you next go to a party at somebody's house, just think about where you go and leave your coats. It's an unusual procedure, because very often you go and leave your coats in the master bedroom, which is normally a taboo area, but under these special circumstances of party you can leave your coats there. These categories of domestic, public, up, down, etc., you just take on without thinking. Most of you have been in a church. But not everybody, I find when I supervise them, realizes that the church is cosmological. It's both a cross, Jesus' cross, but also this is the east end where the sun rises, and that's where the west ends. So this must be the north and that must be the south. So that's in the building, but a lot of people just go into church without being aware of the fact that in the building there are cultural categories. So that buildings, as a child, buildings shape you, And when you grow up, you shape buildings so that you decorate your rooms, you buy houses and paint them and all the rest of it. So that we can see that houses are an expression of individual and collective identity. Individual identity, because the house is you in all sorts of senses, and collective identity, particularly in simple, in peasant and tribal societies, because typically in peasant and tribal society, everybody lives in a house which looks very much the same as everybody else, which is why people like the Cotswolds, etc. The house is also a stage, a setting for social life. All spaces are, we allocate different spaces to different kinds of settings. And this is a point that Irving Goffman has written about. Irving Goffman, I can't remember the reference anymore, it's so long since I read it. But he has a very nice description of a restaurant in Scotland with one of, you know, those sort of swing doors. And he describes how the waiters and waitresses walk through the swing doors so that as they emerge from the kitchen, they put on a nice face and they're like, hello, how are you enjoying your meal and all that? And as they go back into the swing, they say, fucking horrible people in there and that sort of thing, and they spit in the soup, so that there's a public and private space, so that, and by their actions, they create this space, and that they adopt particular modes of behavior according to the different parts of the space. So that we could say that there is a two-way interaction between people and the spaces in which they're operating. On the one hand, space constrains behavior, that you behave in particular appropriate ways in particular spaces. But at the same time, behavior and interaction actually creates that space. So that, for instance, you dress up in the morning, and no doubt your rooms, if you're like most normal people, your rooms, your college rooms are covered in dirty knickers and dirty clothes and all the rest of it. But you can convert that same space into a dining room. You can have a little, you know, mat with nice flowers and two placemats, so that you can convert it into a nice, pretty evening dinner party space if you so wish. A third point is that spaces are symbolic spaces in the sense that very often, in all sorts of different contexts, we project our values and our cultural categories and sometimes our ideas of the way the cosmos itself is organized onto particular kinds of spaces. And this is a point I want to come back to below. But it isn't just our cosmological categories, we also project our emotions and our feelings. Not so long ago I went to the Ace Nursery School and asked all the kids in the Ace Nursery School to draw houses. And this is one of the slides I can't find makes the point. This is one of the typical pictures that these kids in the nursery school produced. But one of them produced a huge large sheet of paper with a tiny little house in one corner. And instead of kind of bright eyes, the eyes are sort of, you know, the eye windows, because the house is, of course, the self, the eyes and the nose and the mouth. This little child produced a tiny little house, and I said to the people, what's this child like? And they said, oh, he's terribly depressed, he's very unhappy. And you could see it in his poor little house lurking down in one corner of his picture. And this is a point that various... Come on, get... Somebody called Bachelard wrote a book, very nice book, called The Poetics of Space, which deals with the way in which we use, or writers and poets use, the house and the attic and the drawers and the rooms, etc., as an imaginary way of conveying their own emotions and personality. So that the house is both, on the one hand, a cosmology, but also a personal space full of emotions. And finally, we use the house I think Susan Bailey's talked about ideas of models. One of the classic models that we use in anthropological and sociological thinking is, of course, the body, but another one is the house. So that we talk of, when we talk of the House of Windsor or the House of Fraser, the House of Windsor, we mean not the building, but the social group, the lineage, the royal lineage. When we talk about the House of Fraser or Harrods, we mean the corporation. So here we've shifted metaphor from the house of Fraser to the body, i.e. the corpse, the corporation, the economic corporation. So that body and houses are two very important metaphors that we use for thinking about society, and they crop up in our kinship thinking a lot. So that on the one hand we talk about blood relatives or a common social body, but in, for instance, in Spanish, when you get married, you casarse, you make a house. To be married is casado, enhoused, literally. So that here again we see houses coming in. So what do we conclude from all this? Well, what we conclude is that buildings and space both mirror and mould their identities, value, their creator's identity and values. And that's what Raglan had in mind when he said the first house was not a hut but a temple. And as I say, this is true of all architecture, but it's particularly true of architecture without architects. In other words, the architecture of traditional societies, which is relatively homogeneous because the designer and user is usually the same person or same group of people. Whilst modern architecture is architecture with architects, in which we get a heterogeneous development of architecture because the designer is typically not the user. And I want in a moment to talk about what happens when architects try to impose their plans upon other people. So we may get the idea, if once we get architecture or architect-designed buildings, then we may get the phenomenon of resistance to architects. I'm bloody well not going to live like you think I ought to live. So what I want to do now is to give you two cases of explicit symbolism in traditional societies. The first one, the Mongolian yurt. Yurt, it's also called a gur. And the second one is my own work amongst the Barasana Maloka or longhouse, and that's the slides I forgot this morning. And then I want to show you, but firstly, how traditional schemas can interpret change, and also I want to show with respect to the Barasana Maloka that there isn't just one symbolic schema, that you can actually have a house which under certain conditions represents a male body and under certain conditions represents a female body. It depends on the symbolic context. And then I want to take two modern cases, firstly UK council estates and how and why people transform their own living space, and finally, briefly, an example of Brasilia, the capital of Brazil, in which, here we get an example in which the architects tried to impose their own wish on the people and the people wouldn't like, they tried to resist what had happened. So let's begin then with the Mongolian yurt or gur. Now, according to Caroline Humphrey, whose ethnography I'm using, this yurt or gur tells us about the key divisions of Mongolian society, and it tells us about their idea of their place in the world. The building is a simple collapse, so it's made actually of, you can't see it, but inside it's made out of a sort of concertina-style lattice work covered with a felt covering, and it's very easily put up and taken down again, and people wander around. And in the middle, it has a central hole with a pipe for the smoke so that we have the fire in the middle. And that center bit is the center of the cosmos. And the yurt always is built so that it faces south, so that we see already that the house is being located within the cosmos in rather the same way as our own churches are. And the central fire is the sacred fire, and so that when you cook, the vapors of the food go up as an offering to the deities. And this building is an ideal, it's not just a representation of the cosmos, but it's also an ideal building, like, for instance, for various English people, either cottages or castles are their ideals. So that city-dwelling Mongolians, even city-dwelling Mongolians, have little yurts put on their gravestones so that when they die, they go back to where people ought to live, in other words, in a little gur. Now, the inside of the house is a microcosm of society and social space. There are rules as to where people sit and eat and sleep, and rules about what is placed where, and these express key social categories, particularly those of age, sex, and genealogical seniority, but also wealth and social status. So that in the house basically operates like this. You've got a front and a back space. The front space is relatively impure and polluted or profane, and the back space is relatively pure and sacred. And then the right-hand side as you face out is the male space, and the left-hand space as you face out is female. So that in this half here you put saddles, bridles, and guns, and in this half here you put cooking pots, and in this part you have the marital bed, and this place here is the kind of holy of holies called the Soimor. So here we have it. The marital bed, the guns and bridles, the Soimor, the sacred bit back down the back with the sacred cooking fire. And all this classifications of space accords with the work pattern, so that men's things, the things that men use, go, saddles, bridles, etc., go in the male space, things that women go in the female place. And that, when we look at how new things are brought into the yurt, we see how they're regarded and categorized. And that's what this is the traditional yurt, and this is what happens under modernity, so that we get Here we get the radio in this Shoimor area, and at the back, the sacred area, we get pictures of, during the revolution, during the communist period, we had pictures of the revolutionary heroes, whereas previously we would have had a statue of the Buddha. So that revolutionary heroes, we can read where the revolutionary heroes are put, tells us a lot about how they're being considered, because they're in a sense substituting for the Buddha. And things which are put in the wrong place count as sin or pollution, so that should you put a milking pail over here, it is polluted because it is not, or should you put your gun here, it gets polluted because it is out of place and therefore in the wrong category. And the idea is, needless to say, being a typically male-dominated society, women's objects in a man's area. So if you put your milking pail here, it pollutes men's space, whilst if a man puts his gun in a female area, the gun gets polluted, so that we get the house that signifies a gender asymmetry. Now, people also manipulate this symbolic system. Most of the time, they don't bother about it in a conscious way, but there are occasions in which people will manipulate the symbolic system in the same way that people can manipulate the house, your own social space. If somebody comes in and sits very formally here, they're likely to be making a formal statement. If they come and plonk themselves down in the kitchen and pour themselves a cup of tea, they're suggesting that they should be treated in a rather different way. And Caroline Humphrey gives the example of a high-ranking Buddhist lama, a rather creepy, self-satisfied individual who visits a particular yurt. And he comes in and he pretends, although in fact he's manipulating the system, he pretends to be very, very humble, and he goes and sits down on this side at the front of the yurt. And this causes terrible consternation because people, for starters, everybody must be lower than he is, because that shows respect. So that because he's sitting down here, they have to crouch almost on the floor and say, no, please, Your Honor, move, you know, go into the right place, etc. And effectively, what he's doing is he's using the space in a coercive way, because by knowing the rules and manipulating them, he is forcing people to abase themselves in front of him. So that here he's consciously manipulating his knowledge of space. Now, what do we conclude from this particular example? Well, I think what one of the conclusions that we can make from this, and this is a point that somebody called Pierre Bourdieu has made. Bourdieu is a French, well, I think he started out as an anthropologist, but he turned into a sociologist and is one of the leading lights of contemporary sociological theory. And Bourdieu's point was that, about architecture in general, is that these categories that are inscribed in architecture, they are there and we can read them off, but it's particularly as anthropologists that we make them explicit and read them off, because we don't take them for granted. But most of the time they're there, they apply routinely and all the time and in all actions. So that the idea that men, for instance, in this society, the idea that men are pure and women polluting, if you live in this society, you live that fact every day, and it becomes natural and true because the world and the world is organized as if it is true. So that because it's organized as if it's true, it becomes true, and it becomes quite literally not just inscribed in the buildings, but also inscribed in people's bodies. It becomes part of what Bourdieu calls their habitus. And here we see the links between the body and the building and clothing. So that we talk about habit both as something that you do routinely, but also we use the idea of clothing as a habit. So the idea of roles, we put on social roles as if we put on clothing, as if we put on masks, so that these become habitual and unconscious, and they become part of our bodily tone or habitus, and they are also part of our habitat, so that within our own language we have this set of ideas enshrined, that categories become embodied and become natural within the context of architecture. And this is what Bourdieu, in his famous essay on the Berber House, all of this is on your reading list, this is what Bourdieu emphasized about architecture, that standard patterns in traditional architecture become taken on in the body and embodied themselves. Now, Bourdieu's point is that this happens very effectively because it never needs explicit telling out. It's only anthropologists who come and make the thing explicit. For the people who live in a system, it's there all the time. It doesn't need to be spelled out. It's taken for granted as the natural order of space. And in a sense, you need to be aware of the fact that anthropologist formalism is interesting and valid, so that when I make these sorts of diagrams, or Caroline Humphrey makes that kind of diagram, it's useful for us to understand them, but we shouldn't imagine that when Mongols walk into their yurts, they say, oh yes, this side, women's space, that side, men's space, over there, sacred, etc. They wouldn't, any more than when you walk into your house, you're thinking, oh yes, this is public space, this is private space. But you do it nonetheless. The second point is that the meanings attributed to space and other cultural arrangements only partially exist separately from what people actually do in them. The meanings are given by the way people act out in particular space. so that the meanings are continuously re-inscribed and renewed, and they can, of course, be changed. Take the example of the middle-class kitchen in Cambridge. The typical Cambridge house, down in the Moseley Belt where I live, the house has a hall and a front room and a back room here, and then a kitchen. And what the trendies have all done is knock out this room here, so they make a nice big room, and then they have kids and they tend to put this wall back again because they regret the lack of privacy. But the other thing was that this room here used to be the dining room, but of course people don't have maids anymore, so they don't dine and they don't have servants who used to live out here. So the kitchen has now become the place where people eat. And this is all Elizabeth David cooking and Delia Smith, that's the name. Yeah, Delia and Elizabeth David and all that. And we see that there's a change in dress, so that the apron, which was something that servant girls used to wear and was made of rather coarse cloth and wasn't at all pretty, is now full of nice, it's kind of Laura Ashley flounces and all the rest of it. Because nowadays the kitchen is the place where the hostess shows off her cooking skills, her latest Delia Smith recipe, and so she dresses the part accordingly. So that the kitchen down by Fort St. George area is now become the kind of public display space where you show off your new smeg oven and all the rest of it. So that meanings are changing, the meanings of space are changing in social time. Let me give you another example in which the meanings are relative to particular, the meanings are and symbolic and social values are relative to context. And this is my example of the Barisana Maloka. Now, I've tried to give you a sketch map, and here is the ground plan of how it works. The house has a front door, which is the men's door, here, and the back door, which is the women's door. And around the back here, we have family compartments, so that you have a group of men and their wives and children living here. Now, the house is also, normal life, the families, a lot of brothers with their unmarried wives live here, but they all eat in the center of the house because they're one happy family. But under certain ritual conditions, the house is said to become the world and also the body. And so that in this context, the central axis, the roof beam of the house, this is the path of the sun. And the house is, whether or not the house is actually oriented east-west, conceptually it's always oriented east-west because that's the path of the sun. And the house is then a world, it's a whole world, so that in those contexts, these posts that support the roof are called mountains, and the roof is the sky, and the front door is the east, and the back door is the west, etc. The house is also a human body, but the orientation and gender of the body depends on which particular context. And there are two contexts in which all this operates, one of which is during initiation, and the other of which, during initiation, a clan, a patrilineal clan, acts as a single unit and gets rid of, in fact, what it does is it locks the women who are from other groups, it locks the women and kids in the back, and you bring to the front of the house, you shut the women who are outsiders, unmarried outsiders in the back, and you bring to the front of the house, sacred flutes and trumpets, which represent the bones of the first ancestor. And under those conditions, when you bring all the flutes and trumpets, which are the bones of the ancestor, together, the ancestor comes alive and adopts the new generation of initiates as his children. So that the house is the ancestor. So that there's a sense that according to the mythology here, the house eats the newborn initiates who are incorporated into the body of the ancestor. And the ancestor, at the end of your 2 months of fasting, which I've told you already, the house vomits out his children. In other words, you come out of your seclusion and you're reborn as adults. So that in this set of contexts, in the context of male initiation, the house is a male body. The house represents the male ancestor. And these Indians have painted faces. So you read the house as this is the front door of the house, which is the mouth of the house. And this is the face of the house. This is the house's backbone. And these the beams on the roof are the ribs of the house. And the back door is, predictably enough, the house's anus. But then there's another kind of ritual, which is to do with being together, being with your in-laws, the people with whom you marry. And in that context, everything turns round in the other direction. I've told you already that in this society, you eat. The symbolism of eating is that the men produce the protein, fish and meat, and the women produce the carbohydrate. And that a meal has to consist always of protein and carbohydrate because it signifies togetherness. Now, the rituals of food giving or alliance or affinity rituals work on this particular piece of symbolism. So what happens is that you invite guests to come and dance in your house, and the guests bring fish or meat, which they offer to the host house. And the host house offers beer, which is a product which is made from manioc, which is like the bread they eat. So that what they do, what the guests and the guests set themselves up as like husbands, i.e. fish or meat givers, and the hosts set themselves up as like wives, i.e. givers of manioc products, vegetable products, and they exchange these just like at a normal meal, husbands and wives exchange food and unite together. So in the male initiation rite, what the clan does is to get rid of its unmarried wives by locking them up and present itself as a single unified body looking out as a male house. It's looking at you with its painted face. But in this other kind of ritual, the rituals are the hosts and guests come together and they share, at the end of the ritual, they share a great big meal in the middle of the house, just like the family shares its meals in the middle of the house. So that the emphasis is upon all the in-laws coming and acting as if they're one big happy family. And in that context, people say that the house is not a male house at all, but the house is female. And they're emphasizing the interiority of the house, not the exterior, not the aggressive painted exterior. They're saying, we're all inside the womb of our mother house. And in this context, all the terms are reversed. So that in this context, this is the mouth of the house, and that is the vagina of the house, and this is the warm womb which englobes everybody else. So that in two different ritual contexts, we have two entirely different symbolic readings of the house. One male, in which the front end of the house is the face and the back, the anus, and the other female, in which all the terms are reversed. And this, in one context, we're emphasizing the clan showing off to its neighbors, and in the other context, we're emphasizing the clan embracing its neighbors in one happy family. So we can't say that the house means one thing, or it doesn't mean the cosmos, or it doesn't mean male, or doesn't mean female. It means all of these different things in different contexts. Let's now, so we got two different symbolic schemes in two different contexts. I'm going to very quickly deal with some two modern examples and then stop. What we've seen in these examples from the Barasana and Mongolia is people's activities acted out in a way which the acting out creates the symbolic and cosmological schema. But the schemes are in no way contested. Everybody lives in the same kind of house. Wherever you go, you have the same house organized in the same way, so that everybody agrees with how it operates. But if the meanings of building are not in them, but put there by people's actions, as I've tried to show you, if the meanings are put there by continuous use, then it follows that people may not always enact the meanings that they're supposed to enact either by the culture or by the architecture. So that we may get a gap between people's theory as to what the house should be and how it operates in practice. Let me give you an example of this, and this is an example from Danny Miller's paper on North London housing estates about how people appropriate ready-made space. So here the picture is of the council providing council estate houses, which are all identical, but people busily making them at their own. In other words, the way they furnish them alters the original intentions of the architect in various ways. Initially, the houses arrive to the consumers as ready-made commodities, but people make them their own by their own particular decor and furnishings. And what Danny focuses on particularly is the way people treat their kitchens. And his best point really has to do with this, the way people decorate kitchens. He points out that white, and in his case they were mainly Irish families, have a strict division of labour in which the men do the division of labour, whilst it's the women who choose the aesthetics, because real men don't care about things like decor. So that what happens is that unmarried single men are effectively paralysed because they don't have anybody to do the aesthetics, so that unmarried single men left their flats as they found them. But in the case of Afro-Caribbeans, there are also gender stereotypes, but they're not about aesthetics. Both men and women conspire together to produce absolutely wild and exotic colour schemes. So that depending on your culture, you've got three possible modes. One in which you have a division of labour, in which the men do the DIY and the women are in charge of the aesthetics, and if you haven't got a woman, then you leave the house as it is, or the flat as it is, but if you have got a woman, then you adopt it in a rather conventional way. If you're Afro-Caribbean, then you have a different arrangement where everybody is into aesthetics and you go completely wild. So that the same house, the same flat, goes in different directions according to ethnicity plus marital circumstances. Let's finally give you an example about the example of Brasilia, where people actually resist. Here we have an example of an architect imposing his particular schema on people who didn't like what they got. Brasilia was a city created quite literally out of nothing in the late 50s and early 60s. It was created in an area which was completely uninhabited, which is the exact geographical center of Brazil. And it was designed by somebody called Lúcio Costa. And the architect was Oscar Niemeyer. And at the time that it was built, Brasilia was the absolute paragon, or the quintessence of modernist architecture. It was inspired by Le Corbusier and others, but this was the ultimate expression of modernism. It was an expression of ultra-modernity and total design. And the idea was that Brasilia would not only symbolize the whole country, Brazil, the new country, which is getting rid of its traditional past and emerging as a new post-colonial nation. And the theory of modernism was that by redesigning architecture, we could redesign the people who lived inside architecture. In other words, knowing that built spaces encode in this unconscious naturalizing way, which I've tried to talk about, knowing that built spaces make us into the people we are, if we then consciously manipulate those built spaces, we can change people, so that architecture can be quite literally revolutionary, and revolutionary at a very particular in a particular personal way. So the idea was that by redesigning, rethinking traditional architecture in Brazil, what effectively Niemeyer wanted to do was to redesign Brazilian peoples to get them out of their traditional way of thinking and the create new modern rational people who were free from traditional ideas. So the idea was basically then that if you design a new city, then you will de facto design new people who live within it. And the plan, but this was what happened. I don't know if any of you have been to Brasilia, but it's a quite extraordinary but also pretty horrible space. It is huge blocks, huge concrete blocks, ranged one in long series with vast avenues, so that the, and in a minute I'll show you ground plans, but what you have is just endless series of vast concrete blocks, and running between them, there are huge motorways and vast amounts of open space. There's lots of open space. So all you have basically in Brasilia is motorways, huge open, unstructured open spaces, and monolithic concrete buildings. Now, the people, the two things that the architects wanted to do, and the two things that the people resisted, the first one was the architects wanted to abolish the idea of streets. They wanted to abolish the intimacy, and also they wanted not only the intimacy of the streets, but also the mixed functions of a street. They wanted to clean the streets up. And the second point is that they wanted to abolish private family space. And the idea was that all this was done in the name of modernity. And the idea of the name of modernity was that a rational city didn't have streets which were an unhealthy mixture of commerce and religion and this and that and the other. That you would have zoned activities. You would have government buildings here, gyms here, dwelling spaces there, shops there, etc. It was all rational. You take the city to pieces and put it in different parts, rationally ordered parts, work, commerce, recreation, residence, etc. And you would separate the cars from the pedestrians, etc. So that in, if you look at Niemeyer's plans and Lucia Costa's ideas, the word street isn't even mentioned. It's actually abolished right through the whole idea. And what they were doing, and we need to go back to the slides here to appreciate this, is they were fighting against what we could call the grammar of the pre-modern city. So here is a ground plan of Ouro Preto, black gold in Minas Gerais, an old colonial city. And what you have here is a series of the blacks are buildings and the whites are open spaces. So if we take this case here, these cases, here's a church. The church is framed within a small multifunctional space, so that there is a kind of interplay between the buildings and the spaces between them. If you walk up Trumpington Street on the way out from here, you will see this point about framing very clearly, that there are a series of closures along, a series of frames, vistas, as you go along Trumpington Street. In other words, streets are effectively kind of sculptural spaces which are bounded by private houses, and so the houses frame the streets, and the streets frame the public buildings roundabout. Now, in Brasilia, we get absolutely no inversion. This is a drastically awful slide. Can we get some more dark? Possibly, yeah. No, it's not really. No, I don't think it's in off. Ah, yes, there. So there, if you can struggle through it, there is Ouro Preto with an old-style street, and here is a huge monolithic Brasilia block. And here it is in, this is a ground plan, so here we have, this is a commercial centre, so there's all you get is these huge, massive buildings and nothing in between. So that there's no framing, everything, Brasilia is effectively a city with, it's all churches and no streets at all. In other words, it's just an endless series of massive monuments with no framing at all. All the buildings are like public buildings, so that the private has been abolished, and this was the idea of Nehemiah, was to create a public society, and that's also why they wanted to abolish domestic space within the household, so that people would go outside, they wouldn't moulder away in their little houses, they would go outside and meet each other, but it wasn't clear exactly where they would meet each other. Now, the paradox is that, though, that if all the buildings are public buildings, and if there are no private buildings to frame the public buildings, then there are effectively no public spaces. It's a city of all churches, but no squares. So what did people do about this? Well, people reacted by making their own streets. And here is an example. This is the front of a commercial building, and it was supposed to have a series of places to, it was supposed to have a series of shop fronts, so people didn't like that because there's no proper car access. All this is greenery. So what, and this was the service area behind these monumental commercial buildings. And what people did was in fact turn the service areas, they turned the building upside down. So they shut down all this bit, which was supposed to be the public facade, and they turned the service area into places with street signs and cars, and they created a street life behind the public buildings. So that they ignored the public spaces and walked to the back to the delivery entrances, and shopkeepers put up their shop fronts on the backs, and they simply ignored the fronts and piled cases, crates, etc. So that they turned the building inside out in order to make it their own. The other thing that the architect did, as I say, was to try to abolish interior private space so that everybody would go off to the social club and go outside. So that they tried to reduce familial space inside the houses by the allocation of people into self-sufficient things called blocos or blocks. Each one with his own shops, clinics, schools, etc. And each particular bloco, the idea was that if you worked in this government department, then you lived in a bloco attached to that department. If you worked in this particular factory, you worked in that factory's bloco. And they created a whole lot of collective clubs, etc., to make people go out. And the key point, the key thing they did was that in Brazilian normal houses, there's a thing called the copa. And the copa is a bit like this area here in a normal Brit house. In other words, it's the public but familial nice place that you hang around in. And this is the sitting reception room, which is the center of Brazilian family life. And what they did was they put up glass walls. In order to get rid of it, they reduced it in size inside these flats. They reduced the size of the copa and put up glass walls so that people no longer felt snug and intimate in their copa. And so that people then cynically described this as poor man's TV, that you could sit in one room and watch what other people were doing in other rooms. And What people did, of course, was again, they hated this, so that they redesigned, they undid the flat that the architects had busily done for them. They put up nice big posters across the glass walls of, you know, those wonderful posters of Canadian Rocky Mountain scenery, and they redecorated it all, and they turned their flats back into the things that they thought they did. So that in the end, people hated Brasilia, but they got round it, they got round the constraints as best they could. The poor did what I've described. The poor made the backs of their shops into streets and made their horrible, nasty little flats as best they could into intimate flats. The rich, to a man and woman, abandoned the city and drove about 30 miles outside to a nice lake where they, of course, reproduced exactly what they liked, which is normal Brazilian housing. So that Brasilia now is a peculiar city because it's got a lot of semi-occupied big public buildings and vast suburbs all around it where people actually live because they like to live there whilst they hate living in Brasilia itself. In other words, the planners hadn't understood the basic anthropological point which I've been trying to get across, which is that the meaning of lived space comes from people's activities, and that people refuse to be redesigned by planners. Unless the architects understand how people live, they will get it wrong. Thank you.